and make a movie. Zach said he might get me a part.
Ruth grinned and then headed back to her room. And Eric stifled a chuckle.
Go on, get it off your chest. I can almost smell the evil about to come out of your mouth.
Exactly what part is Zack Stanley going to get her in a film? Laughed Eric. Australian werewolf in Hollywood.
I really don't know why I'm friends with you. Come on, Nick, look at her.
One of the most famous guys in the world decides he wants ugly Betty as his best mate. I don't believe a word of it.
Well, she seems pretty convinced, so what does it matter? Maybe Zack's fed up of Hollywood bimbos and wants to meet someone normal.
I'll bet you anything she's spent the day sitting in the park, talking to herself. Nicole shook her head, reluctant to concede Eric was probably right.
I bet you $20 that she's at his house tomorrow like she says she is.
Deal, replied Eric, and shook Nicole's outstretched hand. How are you going to prove it? Chapter 49. Declan wiped his backside with the last remaining sheets of paper on the roll and flushed the toilet. Although he'd been in the bathroom for just 10 minutes, he'd kept the door slightly ajar, so as to keep an eye on Matty in the bedroom. His friend lay on his side on the bed, reading a dog-eared European copy of FHM that he'd picked up in the dining room, completely aware of his best friend's beady eyes. The furthest they were ever apart was a partially open door. One of several unspoken rules between them.
"Did you call your mammy?"
asked Declan, drying his hands on his T-shirt.
"Yeah, she sends her love."
"Is she okay?"
"The usual bit tearful. You know what she's like."
"And you?" Declan replied hesitantly.
"I'm good."
"You know, we can go back if you change your mind, don't you? I'll go with you. You won't be on your own."
"Yeah, I know. But I also know what'll happen if we do."
13 months earlier, Navan, Ireland. Mr. John Wallace was proud to have held the title of Navan's postmaster for the last 36 years. To take the pressure off his arthritic ankle, he leaned against the counter as he weighed Mrs. Flynn's parcel. He approved of her traditional use of brown wrapping paper and string to hold it together firmly, rather than cramming it into a padded envelope and reinforcing it with sticky tape. It was the sudden hollering that startled him more than the sight of two figures wearing balaclavas, brandishing handguns and standing by his open door. Mr. Wallace had survived 6 post office robberies to date, unscathed, and he was confident number 7 wouldn't be any different. He'd learned from experience that the modus operandi rarely varied. Remove all the notes from the safe and the till, place them inside the bags the raiders always brought with them as quickly as possible, and, once they left, phone the Gardaí. 4 weeks later, he'd be reimbursed by the powers that be.
"This is a stick-up,"
shouted Matty, failing to control his trembling voice.
"Do what we say and nobody gets hurt."
Mr. Wallace chuckled to himself, wondering if all armed robbers read from the same handbook.
"This is a stick-up?"
Declan asked his friend quietly.
"Who the fuck says that these days?"
"Well, in case you've forgotten, this is my first robbery. Have you got something better?"
whispered Matty through gritted teeth. Declan shrugged, so Matty continued.
"Any of you fucking pricks move and I'll execute every motherfucking last one of you."
Declan rolled his eyes.
"Really? You're going to start quoting Pulp Fiction now?"
Matty's empty threat was greeted by a collective, disapproving sigh from the handful of elderly customers waiting in line to be served. Matty and Declan glanced at each other, puzzled. They'd expected to be feared, not groaned at.
"Is there any need for that kind of language in front of ladies?"
asked Mr. Wallace, evidently offended.
"Sorry,"
replied Matty, before Declan landed a sharp elbow in his ribs.
"What was that for?"
"Why are you apologizing?"
"'Cause I upset the old fella."
"Massively old,"
interrupted Mr. Wallace.
"Little gabshites,"
added Mrs. Norton, grasping her walking frame and tartan shopping bag.
"It's bad enough you have to rob a post office, but to come in and call us... what was it again?"
"Pricks,"
replied her friend, shaking her head.
"Pricks! The mouthy bastards! Shame on you both!
Ladies and gentlemen, you're missing the point, began a rapidly exasperated Declan. We're here to rob the place, not to make friends.
Well, that's a blessing, because with that language you're not going to make any feckin' friends in here.
Give me your money. Everything you got, continued Declan, reasserting his authority, until it was Matty's turn to elbow Declan. Please, he added reluctantly. To a chorus of further disapproval, Declan used his gun to usher the customers towards the wall, while Matty headed towards Mr. Wallace. Matty lobbed their two duffel bags over the thick Perspex counter screens, and Mr. Wallace complied, stuffing them with euros before throwing the first bag back towards him. He wondered why the postmaster didn't look more concerned.
"It's a shame he didn't come yesterday," Mr. Wallace casually added. "Tuesday's pension day, and you've got away with a lot more."
"Deck, did you hear that? We should have come yesterday," said Matty, lifting the bag from the floor.
"Don't use my name, you idiot," snapped Declan.
"Will you be wanting the coins too, Deck?"
added an amused Mr. Wallace.
"Jesus, no. Just the notes, thank you."
As Mr. Wallace hurled the second bag over his booth, he couldn't help but notice the barrel of Matty's gun was solid. He'd been eye to eye with enough barrels to spot the difference between a real gun and a fake.
"Well, it was nice to meet you all,"
added Matty, as he and Declan slung the bags over their shoulders, "and sorry about all of this."
"Ah, don't you worry yourselves, lads,"
smiled Mr. Wallace, now the holder of the divisional record of most robbed post office in the Republic. His wife was always proud when his picture made the local newspaper. As Declan opened the post office door, Matty grabbed a handful of euros and dropped them inside Mrs. Norton's shopping bag, offering her an apologetic shrug.
"Sorry for the bad language," he added,
before he and Declan bolted out of the door and through the town.
"Ah, what nice lads,"
said Mrs. Norton, swiftly changing her tune once she calculated how many lotto scratch cards she could buy with her windfall. Suddenly, her attention was drawn to Mr. Wallace's peculiar gasping sounds, and she turned her head to watch him fall to the floor, clutching his chest. Chapter 50. Today.
"Where's this?"
asked Tommy as he swiped his way from right to left on Jake's mobile phone.
"This is a wind farm I worked on in White Hill, New Zealand. Set in 24 square kilometres of land at the bottom of a hill."
Tommy and Jake sat under the shade of a lifeguard tower, drinking bottles of beer, strictly prohibited on the beach, hidden in brown paper bags.
"And this?"
Tommy continued.
"That's the Lumbini Buddhist pilgrimage on the India-Nepal border."
"How did you end up there?"
"I was in New Delhi, having a coffee enema."
"As you do."
"As you do, and I got chatting to the woman who was shoving the pipe up my arse. When you're naked, flat on your back, cupping your balls with a stranger holding your legs in the air, polite chit-chat's a good way of stopping yourself from farting 5 litres of Nescafe in her face. Anyway, she told me about this town, supposedly being the birthplace of Buddha. So I ended up there, teaching English to the local kids."
"It looks beautiful."
"Yeah, it is. But the enema was a waste of time because I got chronic dysentery and had to leave after a month. Then it was over to Thailand, Vietnam, Singapore, Australia and New Zealand."
"How long do you stay in each place?"
"It depends. I travel by 3 rules. Never outstay your welcome. Leave when no one's looking. And always leave them wanting more."
"So I should expect you to disappear when I'm not looking?"
"Depends on whether there's something worth staying here for."
Tommy glanced up and down Jake's 2 tattoo sleeves, which appeared to be inspired by religious iconography. The lines of numbers running from just below Jake's armpit and down the side of his ribs caught his attention.
"What are they all about?"
"They're the map of my journey from the start to here," Jake replied. "Every time a place makes an impact on me, I get a tattoo of the coordinates."
"So like a 6-foot-tall ordnance survey map?"
"I guess you could say that." Jake chuckled.
"What about that?"
Tommy continued, and pointed to a number 23
etched on the skin between Jake's thumb and forefinger. It's my lucky number. Or unlucky, depending on your way of thinking. Tommy frowned. Google it, added Jake. Suddenly a blonde-haired girl in a one-piece red swimsuit caught Tommy's eye. Her resemblance from afar to Pamela Anderson made him do a double take. He recalled fondly the first porn film his brothers had shown him when he was in his early teens. A sex tape involving Pamela Anderson and an intimidatingly well-endowed ex-husband. I met Pam backstage once, began Jake without thinking, and then immediately shut his eyes and cursed his careless tongue.
You did what? No way! Did you speak to her?
For a bit.
And?
And what?
And what was she like?
Yeah, she was nice.
Backstage where?
Something an old friend was working on. Tommy waited for Jake to expand on his answer, or at least offer an anecdote, but neither was forthcoming.
Don't give much away, do you?
Tommy continued, growing ever more curious and fascinated by his new friend.
I thought us travellers were supposed to share our life stories.
Jake smiled. Always leave them wanting more, Tommy. Chapter 51 Day 6 Eric prayed their pickup truck hadn't been towed away or ticketed by a meter maid as he and Nicole returned to the street where they'd parked. Earlier that morning they'd decided to delay planning the next stage of their mission, which had so far resulted in frustrated dead end after dead end. Instead, they took their minds off their failed journey with a competition to see if Ruth had been telling the truth about her friendship with Zack Stanley. They'd followed a bus from Santa Monica for over an hour and watched from a safe distance as it dropped Ruth off in Melrose, where she then waited for another ride. They followed that bus for a further 30 minutes before she alighted at the foot of the Hollywood Hills. Nicole jumped out of the truck and made a beeline towards the convenience store Ruth entered, crouching out of sight behind a postal van, while Eric parked and ran to join her. They couldn't help but laugh at the absurdity of their actions. When the convenience store buzzed, Ruth appeared with a bulging plastic bag and began her familiar traipse up the Hollywood Hills. Eric and Nicole waited at a safe distance before they followed. However, 20 minutes into what felt like a vertical walk, they were breathless, and their target was nowhere to be seen.
"Bollocks, we've lost her,"
said Eric, craning his neck to look around the intersection for signs of Ruth.
"Shh," whispered Nicole. "She can't be that far ahead, and I don't want her to hear us."
"She'll be too busy listening to the voices in her head to know we're here."
"Let's just keep going upwards. I read somewhere the higher you go in the hills, the bigger the houses are. She seemed to know where she was heading, so she's clearly been here before."
Eric felt the sweat beginning to trickle from his neck, down his back and under the waistband of his boxer shorts. What had seemed like a fun wager was fast becoming a chore, and he was prepared to hand over his $20 bet to Nicole, even though he knew Ruth stood more of a chance of joining the royal family than becoming Zack Stanley's BFF. They turned their heads when they heard a vehicle behind them, and saw a minibus crammed with tourists, driving at a snail's pace up the hill. Through the windows they could hear a tour guide over a tannoy.
"And further up this avenue is where we find the three Z's,"
came a chirpy female voice.
"We call it that because this is where Zac Efron, Zach Galifianakis, and Zack Stanley live."
"Bingo,"
smiled Nicole, beginning to jog to keep up with the bus.
"We're making a habit of turning up at strangers' houses, aren't we?"
11 weeks earlier, Holly Cottage, Great Houghton, Northampton, England. The ancient, white, painted walls and thatched roof resembled someone's idea of what a cottage should look like and not something that actually existed, thought Nicole as she and Eric opened the wooden gate. They made their way up a crazy paving pathway towards the front door. As their taxi pulled away, Nicole recalled it had been a long time since she had taken a day trip out of London. She'd forgotten not everywhere smelled of exhaust fumes and ambition. Mrs. Baker's garden was colourful, pretty, and very neatly kept.
The flowers and shrubs in the borders were spaced symmetrically. The expansive lawns were the greenest things Nicole had ever seen. And the only thing to look remotely 21st century was a set of cubed rattan furniture, sheltered under a large cream parasol. Nicole examined the key in her hand and the address attached to the fob. It hadn't been what either of them had expected to find when they'd lifted the lid of the safety deposit box. "Do you think your fairy godmother's left you the keys to the castle?" asked Eric. Nicole shook her head.
"I doubt it, but someone's been here recently because the lawn's been cut."
Nicole looked at Eric pensively and then knocked on the door.
"What are you going to say if someone answers?"
he asked. "The dead woman left me a key in your address. Do you mind if we have a nose around?"
When there was no answer, Nicole inserted the key into the door's lock.
But before she could turn it, a surly woman with short curly hair and a masculine air about her swung open the door and looked them up and down.
"Oh, sorry. We didn't think anyone was in," Nicole began.
The woman didn't reply.
"My name's Nicole Granger, and this is my friend—" "I know why you're here,"
the woman interrupted, and stepped back into the house, leaving the door open. Nicole and Eric glanced at each other, unsure of how to respond. Nicole pulled the key out of the lock and followed her into an immaculately furnished lounge.
"Wait here,"
the woman ordered and left the room.
"I think that's Maria, her housekeeper," whispered Nicole. "I saw her visiting Mrs. Baker a couple of times."
They scoured the room. Photographs in ornate frames covered a piano and two occasional tables, and above a large open fire was a shelf tightly packed with books. Nicole noted most were either travel guides or collections of images from around the world. She moved on to the photographs, some black and white, some colour, of Mrs. Baker and her husband, and her son and daughter as young children. Recent images included Mrs. Baker and three small children.
"Where do you think the housekeeper's gone?"
Nicole asked. "Probably to put the family skeletons back in their closets," added Eric, before a cough interrupted them.
"You'll find what you're looking for in there,"
Maria instructed, pointing to an open door leading off the kitchen. Nicole and Eric tentatively walked towards it. The room was pitch black and colder than the rest of the house, and Nicole groped around the wall for a light switch. She felt a string and pulled it, and as the fluorescent strip light flickered on, Nicole smiled at what she saw. Chapter 52. Today.
"Savannah, could I, like, bum a few bucks off you?"
Joe asked when their paths crossed in the hostel corridor. Savannah knew exactly what Joe planned to spend the cash on, but it didn't dissuade her, so she reached into her purse and removed a $20 bill.
"Promise me you'll use at least some of it for food,"
she asked hopefully.
"Yeah, sure,"
Joe replied and smiled gratefully. But the years spent watching her father at work in front of a congregation meant Savannah could spot a lie in the dark. She reached her room, then paused, when she found the door unlocked. Ron had been quick to replace the broken handle when she'd asked him, and her safety obsession meant each time she left for work, she'd take a photo of the key in the lock. So later, when she'd question whether she'd locked the door, she had photographic proof it was secure.
"Hello, I'm Jane,"
came a loud, cheery English accent from behind her. Savannah jumped as a chunky woman with cropped grey hair barged past. She stood in the centre of the room with her hands on her hips and a broad smile emblazoned across a makeup-free face. The woman's body shape reminded Savannah of an egg. She put her in her mid to late 50s, and, judging by her cargo pants, her checked shirt and walking shoes, she wasn't in Venice for the beach life.
"Is it just us girls?"
Jane beamed.
"It was just me,"
came Savannah's unwelcoming response. Savannah frowned at Jane's open suitcase lying on the spare bed with rolled-up clothes scattered across the floor.
"I'm sorry I'm a bit messy," continued Jane, But don't worry, I'll have this place spick and span in a few minutes. What's your name?
I prefer to keep the door locked when there's nobody here.
Well, we're both here now, aren't we?
Grinned Jane as she continued to unpack. Savannah sulkily threw her work clothes and makeup box into her handbag, checked the combination padlock was still attached to her locker, and went to leave.
See you later then, Rumi,
continued Jane, undeterred by Savannah's hostility. Yeah, bye, muttered Savannah, deliberately slamming the door behind her. Chapter 53. Nicole sighed when she spotted Ruth squatting on the curb, outside what she presumed must be Zack Stanley's home. Ruth's handbag lay by her side, and she seemed engrossed in her scrapbook of stories about Zack. Nicole was now 100% certain that Ruth hadn't spent the previous day with the film star, and wasn't completely convinced she'd even met him for lunch. She preferred to find the good in people, and had hoped that by some strange fluke Ruth had been telling the truth. But the sight of her, so hopeful and yet so doomed to fail, broke Nicole's heart.
"Shall I go over and say something?"
Nicole asked Eric.
"I don't want to embarrass her, but this isn't right. She's going to get arrested for loitering or stalking or something."
"She's not doing any harm," replied Eric, momentarily sympathetic towards Ruth's pathetic figure. "I think we should leave her be. It's none of our business what she's doing or why she's doing it.
If this is some sort of delusional disorder or if she's having a breakdown, don't we owe it to her to help?
She's not Kathy Bates in Misery and you're not a nurse anymore, Nick. You need to let this go. You can't save everybody." The friends remained in silence for another couple of minutes, neither knowing what they were expecting to happen.
"Come on, let's go," said Nicole eventually,
and reluctantly began the journey back down the hill. "You owe me $20, by the way," added Eric.
"Technically I don't. I bet you she'd be at his house. You didn't specify she had to be in it."
"Cowbag."
"Whatever."
Unaware she'd been followed, Ruth carefully placed her scrapbook back inside her handbag and turned around to look at Zack Stanley's home again. She smiled when she imagined what it was going to be like when Zack left his house and saw her for the first time, how she'd walk up to him and explain how much he meant to her, and how grateful Zack would be, and how she might even receive a hug and a peck on the cheek, and if she made a really good impression, he might even invite her inside for refreshments. So, until that happened, Ruth vowed to remain where she was, and removed a club sandwich and a bottle of Sprite she'd bought in the convenience store. After many failed attempts to diet, she no longer cared about what she ate. Zack would love her no matter what size she was. Ruth had piled on a stone in weight for every year her father had been absent from his family, and there had been 7 to date. Many of their family friends thought of Phil as a cliché for leaving his wife for a secretary less than half his age. Denise was humiliated and hadn't seen it coming, and dutifully, their friends promised to shun him, with her reputation meaning more to her than anything else. Denise would have been mortified if they'd ever discovered Phil's secretary was a 19-year-old called Robert. She only discovered her husband's double life when, by chance, she stumbled on Robert's Twitter feed. He and Phil were supposed to be on a business trip to Italy, not lying on a beach and holding hands in Thailand. Once Phil moved into an apartment in the city with his boy toy, Denise banned him from ever entering the family home again. Even years later, Kevin still remembered being coached by Denise to tell the police that his father had placed his hand in places no adult should ever touch a child. Kevin tried to go along with the lie, but his mind became muddled, and after gentle interrogation from a sensitive officer, the investigation didn't lead to a charge. Meanwhile, Ruth tried to maintain contact with her dad, but as the years went on, he made it increasingly difficult. She missed his hugs, and him calling her Sunbeam,
and sometimes she only remembered how his voice sounded from the recorded voicemail messages she'd hear when she called him. She wouldn't have recognized his handwriting now, even if he had remembered to send her a birthday card. She took another bite from her sandwich, and recalled how, in the beginning, she refused to believe her mother when she claimed her husband was abusing Kevin, and later when she said it was Ruth's fault for his departure, that because she was a big girl, he was embarrassed to be seen with her. Then, as the contact between father and daughter shrank to virtually nothing, Ruth came around to thinking her mother must be right. Why else would a father willfully ignore his child? She suddenly snapped out of her thoughts, removed her phone from her handbag, and took a grinning selfie with Zach's home behind her. She was about to email it to her dad, to give him good reason to be proud of her. Then she remembered why she could never contact him. Or anyone else back home again. Chapter 54. Tommy returned from his bathroom break, and dry retched when he came across Joe lying face down, sprawled across the landing floor. The stench of Joe's urine on a hot day was overpowering, but it was another smell that made Tommy nauseous.
"Jesus, Savannah, he's actually shitting himself. Should we call an ambulance or something?"
"We should probably leave him," she replied, her arms folded, all too aware that her cash donation had probably contributed to the situation.
"He's too high to control his bodily functions, that's all. How's it going to get any better for him? Get money, buy drugs, get high, shit yourself, sleep it off, then get to do it all over again. Maybe he hasn't hit rock bottom yet. How far down is there left to go?" "I don't know, honey. It breaks my heart, it really does."
Tommy shook his head, stepped over Joe's body and made his way towards the hostel's courtyard where he'd left Jake. The sun had moved behind two large buildings that overlooked them, leaving the rarely used courtyard in a cool shade. Tommy joined Jake on cushions placed upon empty, rusty, upturned beer kegs, and hunched over a table to continue their game of chess. The board was frayed, but the squares were still visible, and missing pieces had been replaced with random objects like bottle tops, pen lids, and coins.
"I've not really met anyone like you before,"
said Tommy, moving his rook horizontally. "Is that a good or a bad thing?"
"It's all good, don't worry. It's just that you've seen it all, you've done it all. You seem, you know, pretty sorted. I wish I was like that."
"Oh, it's all just an act. I'm just as fucked up as everyone else in this building."
Jake was far from being fucked up, thought Tommy. In fact, he was probably the most level-headed, laid-back and engaging person he'd ever met. Their day together had flown by, peppered by laughter, anecdotes, and Jake's traveller's tales. And Jake was pleasantly surprised by just how much he enjoyed being revered by his spirited younger sidekick.
"Have you stayed in touch with your family and friends much?"
Tommy asked.
"No, not really."
"Don't you get homesick?"
"Again, no, it's the sacrifice you make for a fresh start. What's that saying? In change, we find purpose."
Like Jake, Tommy didn't feel homesick either. Instead, he felt nostalgic for everything he'd lost the day of the car accident.
"Can I ask you a question?"
Tommy asked suddenly.
"Sure."
"I don't mean to get all heavy and stuff, but do you ever think you might have had the time of your life already and didn't stop to notice?"
"If you think like that, the next 40 or 50 years are going to be very dull."
"I don't know. I can't shake the feeling travelling might be as good as my life gets. This could be my moment."
"Don't be daft. There might be hundreds more moments. Or there might be just one. Or the moment might be a person. I see it like this. People are like the tide. Some come into your life and bring things you'll only need for a short time. And others will bring things you'll carry forever. But some are just destined to disappear."
Tommy wondered which category Sean had fallen into. Seven months earlier, Grand Central Station, New York.
"We're here, mate.
We're actually here."
Neither Tommy nor Sean looked pleased, as they nervously glanced round the main concourse of New York's Grand Central Station. They craned their necks towards the enormous Stars and Stripes flag hanging above them, and puzzled over the zodiac constellations painted on the terminal ceiling. As they turned, their faces became bathed in yellow light, pouring through six high, arched windows.
"Take a picture of me up there."
Sean pointed towards one of the pristine marble staircases, and Tommy waited for the rush-hour commuters to thin out so he could take his shot. When they just came thicker and faster, Tommy gave up waiting, so Sean ended up resembling a Where's Wally drawing. In the 8 hours since their plane had left Heathrow and landed at JFK, they'd negotiated their way to the terminal via the air train and an alien subway system that used colours, letters and numbers and made little sense. Their back muscles already ached under the weight of their overpacked rucksacks, so they found a quiet spot and began unpacking under the four-faced golden clock atop of the information booth.
"We need to streamline," began Tommy, removing a travel hairdryer, electric razor and smart dress shoes. "There's so much crap here we don't need. We're going to have to bin it or my spine's going to start slipping out of my arse before the end of the day."
"I don't think I'll be needing these," answered Sean, removing three cans of Heinz beans, two toilet rolls and a jar of Marmite.
"Keep the Marmite," protested Tommy,
taking out hair straighteners from a side pocket and pointing to them.
"I don't remember you complaining when I put these in."
"Those are an essential."
"Nope, if the Marmite goes, they do too."
"Fine, but when it gets humid, you're going to be looking like a dick hanging out with the only white boy in America with a blonde afro." Tommy and Sean put their discarded goods into a plastic bag to dump in a trash can, rolled up their sleeping bags, secured them under the backpack straps and hung their spare trainers by their laces from side pocket zippers.
"Right, where are we going first?"
asked Tommy. As they moved towards the departure boards, their bulky presence became unwelcome with the locals, when their rucksacks clipped several shoulders.
"Careful, man,"
barked one.
"Asshole! Are you blind?"
yelled another. Sean tried to apologize, but nobody listened. New Yorkers walked with absolute purpose, he noted.
"This is too intense," said Tommy. "I think we should get out of New York, start off slowly to get acclimatized to America, and then come back when we're a bit more used to it."
Sean nodded his agreement and studied the departure boards. "We need a plan. There's a train leaving for Stamford in 10 minutes. Another one going to Newark in 15.
"No plans needed. I've got a better idea. We've got no timetable to stick to. We can go anywhere we want, whenever we want. Follow me."
They walked towards the platform, searching for a rare ticket booth without a closed shutter. Eventually, they settled on a machine, and Tommy closed his eyes, pushed a random destination button, and inserted a $50 bill.
"Let's see where we'll end up, shall we?"
Sean grinned and gave Tommy a high five. Sean shielded his somber face from the lashing rain with the hood of his cagoule.
"We should have checked where the train was going before we caught the first one out," he began.
Tommy glanced around the near-empty station platform as Sean's finger traced a train line in a map book. A vending machine lay on its side, its glass door smashed and emptied of its confectionaries. Both signs informing them of where they'd reached were covered in graffiti, rendering them illegible.
"So where are we?"
asked Tommy.
"I wasn't really listening to the conductor when he said where the final stop was," admitted Sean.
"But we're about an hour out of New York, so we could be north or south, or west, or maybe east."
"Big help, mate."
"We could be in Rensselaer.
No, it's Denville. Or maybe Fairfield.
Like I said before, we need a plan."
"Well, at least we're on the move."
"I think moving again very soon could be a good idea."
Tommy looked puzzled until he saw what Sean was staring at. Ahead of them, a bearded man in a tatty army uniform, dirty trainers, and pushing a baby buggy loaded with empty soda cans, shuffled towards them. It was the bread knife in his hand that caught their attention next. They quickly rose to their feet, threw on their backpacks, and frantically searched for an exit sign.
"You looking at my blade, motherfucker?"
yelled the man, wide-eyed.
"'Cause it's looking at you!'
"'Oh, fuck!' muttered Tommy, just as a train appeared from around the corner and stopped at the platform. As soon as the doors opened, they darted inside, scurried through the carriages and threw themselves onto seats. They breathed more easily as they slowly pulled away, while the man with the bread knife walked alongside the moving train, banging on the windows. Sean leant towards a woman sitting opposite him.
"'Excuse me, where's this train heading, please?'
Tommy and Sean walked towards the departure board at Grand Central Station, no longer caring who they bumped into or what insults were hurled in their direction.
"'Let me spell this out for you. We are making a fucking plan,' growled Sean.
And Tommy nodded obediently. Chapter 55 Today Nicole never commented on it, so as not to inflate Eric's ego any further. But she was always impressed by how he seemed to know every lyric to every song he heard on the radio. And he didn't have a bad singing voice, either. As they drove back to the hostel from their reconnaissance mission to learn what Ruth was really up to, Eric sang along to both parts of Beyoncé and Shakira's Beautiful Liar, playing on a pop radio station. Nicole struggled to keep a signal on her phone long enough to open up Google and seek inspiration on where to travel to once they left Los Angeles. "'Found anything yet?' Eric asked, flicking on the dipped headlights as dusk fell. "'No,' Nicole replied, and, frustrated, threw her phone into the glove box.
"'I remember Mrs. Baker saying something about her and her husband sleeping in the back of the car one night by a lake. If I could get a bloody signal, I'd look up lakes near Route 66.'
"'That sounds pretty vague, Nick.
"'No more so or no less than your suggestion of going to Bakersfield, "'just because it sounds like her surname.'
"'Eric fiddled with the dial on the radio "'and picked up a classic 70s music station "'as the opening bars of a song played. "'A small part of him still quietly harboured a desire to sing professionally. "'But as it was harshly pointed out by Jerry Garland,' when he auditioned to be part of the group Lightning Strikes 3.5 years earlier, he was more old boy than boy band. He remained grateful that humiliating clip never aired.
"'A long, long time ago,'
he sang along,
"'I can still remember how that music used to make me smile.'
"'What's this song?'
Nicole asked, noting its familiarity.
"'How on earth could you not know?'
"'It's Don McLean's American Pie. "'I bet you only remember the Madonna version,' Eric sniffed. "'His was a classic, but she ruined—'
"'Shut up!'
"'Nicole interrupted and turned the volume up. "'Six verses, and 8 minutes later she slammed her hand down on the dashboard triumphantly.
"'It's in the song!' she yelled. "'Where Mrs. Baker wants us to go, it's in the bloody song!'
11 weeks earlier, Great Houghton, Northampton. We trekked halfway across London, then into the middle of nowhere.
"'For that?'
asked Eric in disbelief. Before them was an old left-hand drive white pickup truck. Caked in a film of dust, the two right tyres were flat and gave it an awkward stoop. "'We could have cut the middleman and bought a car from Exchange and Mart,' Eric continued.
"'It's more than that,'
said Nicole.
"'It's the truck Mr. and Mrs. Baker travelled America in on their honeymoon. "'She didn't mention they'd brought it home with them.'
Nicole peered through the passenger window and spotted a wooden box on the tan leather seat. The door opened with a creak, and she lifted the lid to find a handwritten letter inside. "'What does it say?' asked Eric. Still disappointed their quest had resulted in such a rusty old treasure, Nicole began to read out loud.
"'To whom this may concern, since my beloved husband died, I have spent years searching for a like-minded soul to appreciate what Joseph and I worked so hard to achieve.
Reluctantly, I ruled out my family as they were not there when their father took ill or to support me afterwards, when I struggled to pick up the pieces. But if you are reading this, then I have chosen you. Like me, you long for adventure. My body will not allow me to travel any further in this lifetime, but yours will. And only when you allow the warmth of new experiences to fill your heart will you truly realize how precious a gem your life is. With everlasting gratitude, Grace Baker. What is any of that last part supposed to mean? Eric said. As Nicole reread the letter to herself, Eric put his hand inside the box and took out 10 rolls of banknotes. He took the elastic band off one of them and counted the £50 notes. Jesus, Nick, there's £10,000 in this. So she has left you money after all. No, pondered Nicole. There's more to it than that. What else is in the box? Eric dug out a business card with a British address that appeared to be a company exporting vehicles to the US, and some car registration documents. There must be a clue in the letter, said Nicole, before picking up an atlas from under the box and flicking through it. Thanks, Thelma. I'll fire up the mystery machine. You go grab Scooby.
Look, she's left a bookmark on the page for Chicago, and another one for Santa Monica in Los Angeles.
It looks like the start and end point of Route 66. It's a bloody long road. Where will you begin?
Where will I begin?
Asked Nicole, surprised.
It's not I. It's us. We're in this together, my friend.
Neither noticed Mrs. Baker's housekeeper standing behind them, her hands clasped and fingers tightly entwined, silently praying her panicked decision had been the correct one. Chapter 56. Today. Tommy carried the chessboard and headed towards the cupboard where the boxes of board games were stored. He became distracted by shrieking sounds behind Matty and Declan's closed bedroom door. He couldn't resist placing an ear to it, to hear what was causing the ruckus. But without warning, the door suddenly opened, causing Tommy to lose his balance and fall into a heap on the floor inside, chess pieces scattering across the threadbare carpet.
"We have a guest, ladies," began Declan, as Tommy looked up to find two Asian girls he didn't recognize, lying on beds, and Matty and Declan wrapped only in towels. Tommy felt his cheeks blush, and his hands sprang into action, scrambling around to grab the pieces to put back in the box.
"Next time you can watch, if you like,"
added Matty, while Tommy took the board and hurried out of the room. With another successful humiliation under their belts, Tommy vowed to make it a priority to toss the two cuckoos out of his nest as soon as the opportunity arose. And he wouldn't have long to wait. Chapter 57. Eric leaned back on his plastic chair by the hostel's two-coloured IMAX and blew cinnamon gum bubbles as Nicole scanned the computer screen. Her eyes moved from the web pages to the notes she was frantically jotting in a book. Eric was bored. He cracked his knuckles, picked at a scab on his ankle, felt for rogue protruding nostril hairs, and glanced at Jake sitting on a sofa reading a book about holistic health and yoga. He puzzled over where he recognized Jake from, but couldn't put his finger on it. Suddenly Nicole slammed her pen down and threw herself back against the chair.
"Buffalo Springs Lake, Texas, that's where we're going,"
she began with a satisfied smile.
"And how did you come to that conclusion?"
yawned Eric.
"Okay, I'll explain, but you need to concentrate. The clues are all in that song American Pie. Mrs. Baker started singing it the last night I visited her and talking about sleeping in the back of the truck by a lake. She was telling me about her trip around America with her husband in 1971 on Route 66. Well, that was the year the song was released. According to Wikipedia, the song's about, well, at least in part, the singer Buddy Holly dying in a plane crash. That's why Don Henley sings about the day the music died."
"Henley? You mean McLean?"
"Whatever.
But didn't Buddy Holly die in the 1950s or something?
Yes, but he was born in Lubbock, Texas. And which road goes through Lubbock, Texas? Route 66.
That road goes through a lot of states, Nick, as you well know, because I drove through most of them to get to L.A., and I swear Lubbock was one of the towns we passed.
Will you just let me finish?
Nicole replied indignantly.
Read the lyrics. He talks about a pickup truck and driving a Chevy to the levee. What are we driving?
A Chevy pickup truck, but what's a levee?
It's an embankment or flood bank that regulates water levels. And where would you find one of those?
At a lake?
Exactly. And where did I tell you Mrs. Baker and her husband slept one night?
At a lake.
And near Lubbock, Texas, you'll find Buffalo Springs Lake. The song also has references to the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost and having faith in God above, and there are at least four churches there. He sings about dancing in the gym. There are 10 schools in Lubbock, by my reckoning. There's a line, I could make the people dance. And there's half a dozen dance studios. As for the church bells all were broken, well, St. Teresa's Church hasn't had working bells since 1971. Plus Lubbock contains everything mentioned in the song. A courtroom, an American football team. They even have the All Lubbock Marching Band Parade. A reference to the Jester, that's Bob Dylan's nickname, and he's twice played Lubbock. Do you see how this all fits?
Eric knew Nicole was desperately attempting to find clues in almost everything Don McLean recalled about small-town life. But he kept it to himself that there were probably hundreds of other towns that might also fit the bill. And in the absence of any better suggestions, he nodded. But the more time he gave himself to think about it, the more he came around to agreeing Nicole could be on to something.
It's roughly 1,200 miles from here, continued Nicole. If we set off in the morning, we can be there in about a day.
What are we going to find when we get there?
Let's cross that bridge when we come to it. But I've a gut feeling this is going to change everything for us.
Nicole had no idea how right she was, but not in the way she'd hoped. Chapter 58, Day 7. Ruth was unaware of the poppy seeds accumulating between her teeth as she tucked into a third cream cheese bagel. She sat on a fold-up chair purchased from an Outward Bound store in Santa Monica, finished her breakfast and reached inside her bag for her knitting. No one had bothered to answer Zach's intercom that morning, but Ruth was positive someone was inside the house, as the patio doors were now closed, and the CCTV camera quietly changed direction soon after she pressed the button. But a single-minded Ruth wasn't easily dissuaded when she was so close to her goal, so she sat contentedly and continued to knit Zach's jumper. She noticed nobody seemed to walk in the Hollywood Hills, as no matter where she wandered, and it was never far from Zach's house, she had yet to speak to another person. Even the uniformed Hispanic staff entering and leaving Zach's neighbors' homes used cars or vans. Every couple of hours, Ruth made her way around the corner, squatted in a patch of bushes, and relieved herself into an empty McDonald's cup. And when the sun began to heat up the sidewalk, she pulled out a stripy parasol that came with the seat and stuck it into the grass verge. And as the hours ticked past in her lonely public vigil, Ruth's determination to meet Zach grew ever stronger. 3 weeks earlier, Victoria, Australia. Ruth nervously played with her hair as the glass elevator rose to the 22nd floor of the plush apartment block. The doors silently opened, and she scanned the corridor for number 223. She was skittish, yet excited, and knocked on the solid wooden door a little louder than she'd intended, so it echoed through the corridor. Inside, she heard footsteps on a tiled floor before it unlocked, and her father answered, casually dressed in sweatpants and a T-shirt that was too tight for a man of his age.
"Hi, Dad,"
began Ruth with an eager smile. Phil looked at his daughter for the first time in almost 3 years. She was heavier than he recalled, and it had aged her. She didn't resemble either him or his bitter ex-wife. "Well, didn't I know you were coming over?" he replied, flustered.
He part closed the door behind him, but didn't move towards her.
"I haven't heard from you for a while, and I wanted to say hi,"
continued Ruth, hopefully.
"You really should have called first."
"I did. I left messages on your machine and at work and on your mobile phone."
"Oh, right. Okay. Well, I've been busy. You know how it is."
Ruth nodded and smiled.
"Can I come in?"
It's not really convenient right now, Ruth. Another time, maybe."
"Well, I came to say goodbye. I'm going to America to..."
"Okay, well, enjoy yourself,"
her father interrupted, smiling vacantly, and began to turn his back on her. Ruth's heart sank when she realized the father who swept in and out of her life on his terms was terminating their all-too-brief reconciliation. She'd imagined they might spend the afternoon together, catching up on each other's news like old friends. He would ask questions about her job, and she would tell him all about Zack and the competition she'd won. Then anger suddenly displaced the disappointment she felt, so she pushed open the door her father was trying to shut.
"Aren't you going to ask why I'm going to America?"
asked Ruth forcefully.
"Ruth, I don't have time for this. I'll see you soon, I promise."
"Why don't you want anything to do with me, Dad? What have I done wrong? I'm a good person. I really am."
Phil took a bulging leather wallet from his pocket, removed a handful of dollars and handed them to her.
"There, you don't need anything from me now, right?"
Ruth couldn't disguise how let down she felt. She swallowed hard and willed the tears forming in her eyes to go away. Suddenly a small, sinewy, Southeast Asian girl, no more than 2 or 3 years of age, appeared by Phil's waist.
"Daddy, who is this man?"
smiled the girl and pressed her hand into his palm. Ruth's mouth slowly fell open as her father struggled to find words.
"It's a girl. She's a friend of mine, Sunbeam,"
he replied.
"Sunbeam,"
repeated Ruth, realizing she'd been replaced.
"Lucy, leave Daddy alone,"
a male voice said from behind the door as it opened further.
"Who are you talking to?" "Oh, hi, Ruth. How are you?"
Phil's boyfriend, Robert, offered Ruth a superficial smile, but she had no idea how to respond to the sight of her father's replacement family, or the new sunbeam in his life. She stepped backwards towards the lift.
"Ruth,"
began her father, but the lift door closed before Ruth heard anything else. Chapter 59. Today. Eric parked the truck at the hostel curb, and Nicole and Tommy lifted suitcases into the flatbed and secured them with ropes. Eric ignored both Tommy's presence and assistance, and remained in the truck fiddling with the radio, leaving Nicole to say goodbye.
"Well,"
said Tommy, and smiled at Nicole.
"Well,"
she replied, and returned his smile.
"Good luck with the rest of your trip."
"Thanks."
Nicole wanted to tell Tommy that in different circumstances she would have returned his kiss, and that the burden of a secret she couldn't reveal would always get in their way. But both were aware their moment had passed.
"I've sent you a friend request on Facebook," Nicole continued, "so we can stay in touch if you like."
"That'd be good."
Tommy stretched his hand out awkwardly to shake Nicole's. Instead, she hugged him and gave him a peck on the cheek until an impatient Eric honked the horn. As the truck pulled away, Tommy felt a little envious of Nicole's next adventure, even though she'd been cagey about what it involved or where she was going. But while he'd enjoyed her company, he was also looking forward to spending more time with Jake and learning more of the world by living vicariously through his anecdotes. Jake had encouraged Tommy to consider whether it was time to throw the security blanket of the Venice Beach International Hostel to one side and experience more of America by himself. However, when he gave it proper thought, he knew he was too scared and too broke to do it alone, and it would take the actions of his past and present colliding before he could ever move forward. Chapter 60.
Over there,
began Nicole, pointing to a greenish verge with a panoramic view further up the highway. Eric pulled the indicator lever down and the truck ground to a halt by the side of the Arizona road. What do you reckon? He asked and turned to face Nicole.
Yes, this looks like a nice place.
They exited the truck and stretched limbs that felt tight after 7.5 hours of continuous driving. Route 66, both ahead and behind them, was silent and should have been straight as a die, had the sun's incalescence not made it wobble like jelly. But the mainly barren landscape was pure picture-book America. Eric lifted himself into the back of the truck to remove the cardboard box where Mrs. Baker's urn was stored. Then he followed Nicole as she walked towards a grassy knoll with a canyon-like drop below.
"Hey, it's Eric and Urn,"
Eric joked, and looked to Nicole for approval. She ignored him.
"Didn't Bridget ask you why you wanted her mum's ashes?"
she asked.
"What kind of woman gives something so precious to a complete stranger?"
"The kind who couldn't care less, I suppose. People can be shits, Nick."
"I guess so. Okay, let's do this."
Eric passed Nicole the urn, and she tore off the tape that kept the lid firmly in place. Then she took a deep breath and began to shake the ashes into a light breeze and watched Mrs. Baker make her final journey towards the snow-capped Mount Eldon, beckoning from the distance.
"Goodbye, Mrs. Baker, and thank you for this opportunity,"
Nicole whispered and smiled. Eric placed his arm around her shoulder and felt her head tilt towards him. After a few moments of silence, Nicole wiped away the tears pooling in the corners of her eyes, carefully placed the empty urn on the ground, and returned to the truck. Eric waited a moment longer and absorbed the view of the arid landscape surrounding him. "Goodbye, Mother," he muttered, and spat on the ground where a small pile of ashes rested. Part 2. The Departures. Chapter 1. Day 8.
"Come on, men," snapped an unusually competitive Paik. "It's an easy shot."
"No pressure, then,"
Tommy replied, and arched his back over the pool table, stretching his fingers over the black ball to knock the cue ball into the yellow. It glided into the pocket with ease.
"Lucky," said Paik dismissively, as the music in the hostel lounge became louder.
A group of Australian girls in their late teens scanned a TV screen, awaiting direction before frantically aping the animated dance steps flashing before them. Tommy resented the popularity of Matty and Declan's stolen Xbox One, and that fact that his adversaries had become the center of attention because of their gift and vivacious personalities. When one girl lost her balance and jostled Tommy, he missed his shot. Only her apologetic smile stopped him from snapping at her.
"Which rules are we playing?" Tommy asked. "American or European?"
"What's the difference?" asked Paik. "The biggest difference is that Americans don't play a lot of snooker or three-cushion billiards," interrupted Jake, putting his first, second, then third red with ease. "Americans mostly play 8-ball and 9-ball, along with some one-pocket or 14.1 straight pool."
Tommy and Paik looked at him and raised their eyebrows.
"What? I'm more than just a pretty face, lads."
When Jake missed the fourth red, he passed the only cue to Sadie, the receptionist. Tommy leaned against the wall, his eyes darting between Jake and one of the amateur dancers who was offering him kittenish glances.
"If this was snooker, would you be going for the pink or the brown?"
whispered Paik, clearly amused with himself.
"What?"
Tommy replied, thrown off guard.
"You know what I mean."
"If I do, then you are way off."
Paik shrugged and turned to take his shot. Suddenly, the booming bass of a familiar pop song blasting from the TV interrupted their game.
"Hey!"
yelled Tommy.
"Turn that off!" "Why should I?"
the Australian girl yelled indignantly.
"Because I said so,"
replied Tommy angrily.